And that's not counting those who were killed in Gaza. And for the first time in 18 years, the Israeli regime attacked Jenin from the air in drone attacks. All of this is taking place while the land theft and destruction of homes and lands continue by the Zionists. And the overall oppression by the regime seems to get worse by the day. We're going to take a look at all of this on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Out of Berkeley, Paul Larube, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement. Out of Tripoli, Mostafa Fathouri, Libyan academic and journalist. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Paul, let me start off with you. I mean, why do you think we have seen an increase in the amount and severity of attacks by the regime on the West Bank this year?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Marzieh. The number of attacks and the number of deaths is constantly increasing. It has been for decades, not simply years or months. And the Israeli policy appears to be to gradually heat up the pot in which the frog is cooking. And so that those of us who are observers from outside get accustomed to this level of violence. They're taking actually a lot of their cue from the ethnic cleansing that the United States did of the North American continent. Hmm. And ultimately, they decimated the North American population. So that's what they want to do. Now, there's some impatience among some of the Israelis. They want to do it faster. But until now, at least, the Israeli authorities have tried to keep it somewhat under wraps so that we don't have an incident where 100 Palestinians are killed in one day, for example, mm-hmm. or something like that. But that's what they're doing. They're gradually increasing it so that it doesn't appear in the Western news. And they've been successful in limiting the exposure in the Western news.
Well, Mostafa, since the start of this year, as I said, at least 186 Palestinians have been killed on the West Bank alone. What kind of message do you think the regime is basically trying to send, one, to Palestinians, and two, to the rest of the world?
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank
first
you for
of
coming.
All, I think the main message the Israeli government is sending out is the fact that it's determined to make the world and the Palestinians, first of all, of course, forget any talk or any discussion or any debate about the idea, which is becoming increasingly impossible, the idea of the two-state solutions. I mean, terrorist Netanyahu himself, as a prime minister, has repeatedly said this. I think the most recent statement to that effect he made about something like a week ago, that the whole world and the Palestinian first should forget the entire idea of the two-state solution. That's one thing. The other thing is the message for the Palestinians. We have to remember this is the most fascist government in the Zionist entity ever since it was created in 1948. And it's full of criminals who are ministers in this government, especially the Minister of Internal Security, who has repeatedly expressed the idea or supported the idea that Palestinians, wherever they are in the West Bank or in Jerusalem, around Jerusalem, or anywhere else in historical Palestine, they should be forced out of their homes, out of their lands. So this is the platform the current government of the Israelis was elected on, and they are trying to deliver, if you like, to their electorate that we are doing what we have promised you throughout the last 2 years. And the message to the world most probably, I would say, that the Israelis are telling the world, especially the United Nations and the big powers, their supporters, of course, like the United States, that we in Israel, we don't really give a damn, we don't care about what the international law says, or what you like or you don't like, as long as we see our interests as Israelis, as the Zionist colonial power in the region, in a certain way, and we are going to pursue those interests regardless of what you think or you believe, even if you are our allies like the United States.
Hmm. Well, Paul, if those Western supporters of the dream of the regime would put real pressure on the Zionist entity, do you think that we would see a different reality?
We would see it overnight. We would see it overnight if the United States decided that it was not going to support Israel anymore. Then Israel would cease to exist in an instant. But that's not the case, because the United States is, largely speaking, still, as it was two centuries ago, a racist country. And Israel is a racist country and becoming more racist. And as Mustafa said, this is the trend of Zionism. And Zionism is apparently the strategy of Zionism is to become more extreme. I say it's a strategy, not merely a development. It's a strategy because in order to create a Jewish state that's essentially exclusively a Jewish state, you need to get rid of the indigenous population, the Palestinians. And in order to do that, you need extremists more than anybody else. And the Israeli government and the Zionist movement are investing much more of their funding into the extremists who are get almost everything that they want in order to grow. And they're growing not only in their extremism, but also in their numbers. The birth rate among the extremists is much higher than the birth rate among the other Zionists in the state. So I think they see this as the future, even though this is not popular with the vast majority of Zionists outside of Palestine. In the U.S., for example, most of the American Jews, I would say, are opposed to a more racist form of Zionism. But that's not going to make
it. Let me just jump in here, Paul, with what you're saying. But when we talk about Zionists in general in the United States, you say that the majority of them, you believe, are opposed to a more racist form of it. But they do not say a lot against the Israeli regime on a day-to-day basis to begin with. So I guess it's all relative as far as when we're talking about how extreme the Zionists can be, because overall they support that Zionist entity. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, Marzia. That's exactly the problem. They don't want, or many of them have abandoned Israel, but they haven't gone against it. They're sick of Israel and Zionism, but they haven't turned against it.
Right, right. Well, Mustafa, do you think the main reason that entities like the U.S., U.K., Canada, and other like-minded countries which support the Zionist regime, you think the main reason that they continue to support it is because they too are settler colonial states? I mean, basically, they're on the same page with Tel Aviv.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. With that point in particular, and the history, as our friend Paul said, I mean, the history of both the Zionist movement as well as the new nations, if you like, that emerged in North America, if you take the United States as an example, or Canada as an example for that matter, what happened was the eradication of the indigenous population of these places. So they achieved what they call a land without any population for or people without for people without any land. So it's kind of the same basic principle that the Zionists have applied in Palestine ever since the 19th century, the start of their mass migration from different countries in the world to historical Palestine. And we also have to remember that the Israelis, and as well as the extreme Zionists, especially those responsible for helping Jewish people migrate to Palestine, they always encourage, if you like, the most rotten elements of society, whereas, any failed fanatic who lives in New York and having a difficult time making it, through his life daily because of expenses, because of the rise of cost of living and so on and so forth, they would encourage him to go to Palestine, where he will be welcomed, and then most likely he will get free, housing or something, other benefits, just to stay there. When we have seen hundreds of criminals who actually migrated, especially from the United States, to historical Palestine and took over the Palestinian land, Palestinian homes, Palestinian apartment buildings, and so on and so forth. So whether, these countries, especially the United States, they do share what they call values of freedom and so on and so forth with Israel, which is not true, but they also share the basic fact that both of them came into existence at the expense of the indigenous population, as we have seen in North America, as well as in Palestine. So there is a kind of shared tragedy for the indigenous people in both situations, and for the United States to defend against that. So they don't want anybody to talk about this. What they would say, we are defending Israel, we are allies with Israel, because Israel represents freedom, represents the new world, represents the kind of openness and coexistence, but only for everybody else, if you like, who's Jews, but not for the Palestinians, not okay. for the Arabs.
Okay. Well, Paul, why do you think Jenin has been targeted in the way it has this year? At least 10 of the Palestinians who've been killed on the West Bank have been from Jenin. And we saw the regime targeting the area from the air with drones recently, something they hadn't done, at least targeting from air, in years. So what's your assessment of what's going on there and why Jenin is being targeted in the way it has?
Well, Jenin was special even in 2002 when the Israeli military under Sharon had its incursion into West Bank cities, all except Jericho at the time, although they moved into Jericho later. And Jenin was, in a sense, one of the most difficult. The refugee camp in Jenin put up some of the greatest resistance to the extent that the Zionist military and its bulldozers and tanks leveled a quarter of the refugee camp during that time. And I think, if I remember correctly, the greatest number of casualties who were there. Well, it has always been a center of resistance, and that continues to this day. So that's one reason the Israeli forces have chosen it as a target. But there may be other reasons that we don't know about, such as that they want to cleanse that area as a priority before other areas. It's hard to say.
Right.
But certainly the courage of its fighters and the extent to which they have been able to mobilize their resistance, I think, is a major part of it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mustafa, after more than 70 years of oppression by the Zionists, do you think that the regime's founders thought that they would have suppressed all Palestinians into submission by now to accept the Zionist regime? But the reality is couldn't be further from the truth. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, the main principal goal of the Zionist entities always has been and the crushing to know, you know, to know without any limits actually of any Palestinian descent, if you like, not just resistance or armed resistance. They have tried every imaginable, every evil tactic, if you like, to do so, but they have miserably failed. And as we have seen in the example of Jenin, for example, I would like to point out for the audience here that there are two Jenins, if you like, in Palestine. One Jenin, the city whose history goes back to the 18th century, and the other one, or Jenin municipality, or something a little bit bigger. And then we have the Jenin refugee camp, which was created in 1953, inhabited by those who were forced, those Palestinians, who were forced out of their homes, out of their lands, when Israel came into existence in 1948. And then more people came after the Israeli invaded and occupied the West Bank in 67. So Jenin, in a way, it's actually the refugee camp, the Jenin refugee camp, that's putting up the most resistance. And one of the striking features here, or notable things, is that most of the people who were operating there, mostly associated with the commands and structures of Palestinian resistance organizations like Islamic Jihad and Hamas in Gaza, which is not actually in the West Bank. What this tells us? It tells us that there is a new generation, you know, coming back to claim its right to the resistance. And the only way for the Israeli entity to end the problem in Jenin, for example, is let those people in the Jenin refugee camp, the solution is very simple. Let them go back to their homes and their lands, and their enterprises, which he confiscated in 1948 and following years, and there will be no Jenin problem in Jenin at all. But as long as those generations and their following those refugees, I mean, and their following generations are still refugees, they will never give up. Mm. So whatever Israel is, would like to use any kind of method, any kind of tactic, or any kind of weapons, and they have used internationally banned weapons like phosphorus and other things, you know, it will fail. Ultimately, it will fail. Okay. You forced me out of my house. I will never give up. And if I die without getting back to my house, my sons, my daughters, my neighbors, they will never give up. It's going to be the same. So it's you know, if there is no return for the Palestinians, consequently, there will be no security for the Israelis, especially those who attempt to grab more Palestinian land by establishing what they call outposts, which are small colonies, actually, before the being developed into a proper standard colonies.
Well, Paul, in your perspective, What is key here in order for the Palestinians to, one, fight this repression and the continual Western support for the Zionist regime and ultimately become victorious over the Zionist entity?
Well, I think the key is, first of all, as Mustafa said, the Israelis do not have security, and they will never, ever have security. Never. They, as long as they remain racist, as long as they think of the Jews as a superior race on this planet, they will never have have security. And that's true for any other group of people who consider themselves above the rest of the people on this planet. But as far as the Palestinians are concerned, they're maintaining their resistance. There are methods, we can argue about what methods are the most effective in fighting.
But you're saying resistance is key. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Resistance is the key. But I think that the resistance may not have the full effect until the disappearance of the influence of the United States, especially, and the West in general. And I think that that's most definitely coming. The West has extended itself too far with respect to Ukraine, and it has lost its industrial base altogether. It can't survive much longer. The dollar is tumbling, and the dollar will no longer be king in the world. So at that point, Israel will have the Zionists will have lost their main backer, and I honestly doubt that they will find backers outside the West that will give them the kind of support that they need in order to survive. And at that point, they're going to disappear.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this Spotlight. Paul Arudi, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement out of Berkeley. Mustafa Faturi, Libyan academic and journalist out of Tripoli. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 11th and 12th verses of Surah An-Nur.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن الذين جاءوا بالإفك عصبة منكم لا تحسبوه شرا لكم بل هو خير لكم لكل امرئ منهم ما اكتسب من الإثم والذي تولى كبره منهم له عذاب عظيم.
Indeed, those who came with falsehood are a group among you. Do not think it bad for you, rather it is good for you. For every person among them is what punishment he has earned from the sin. And he who took upon himself the greater portion thereof, for him is a great punishment.
لولا إذ سمعتموه ظن المؤمنون والمؤمنات بأنفسهم خيرا وقالوا هذا إفك مبين.
Why, when you heard it, did not the believing men and believing women think good of themselves and say, this is an obvious falsehood?
Regarding the first verse, dear listeners, I mean the 11th verse of the total chapter, we said that it is understood that an innocent person is accused of an unchaste act at the dissenting of these verses, and the rumor is spread throughout the society, and some people do want to somehow benefit from this rumor that is spread along the society. But the Holy Quran, without mentioning the main phenomenon, says that you should not regard it an evil to you. It is good to you. And by means of it, the evil intentions of those hypocrites and the enemies are uncovered, and those outwardly good people who are of bad characters are totally disgraced. Now, in the next verse, I mean, the verse that says, لَوْلَا إِذْ سَمِعْتُمُوهُ, the believers who were deceived in this affair and were influenced by this group are severely reprimanded through a few verses. Now, this verse says, لَوْلَا إِذْ سَمِعْتُمُوهُ ذَنَّ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتُ بِأَنفُسِهِمْ خَيْرًا وَقَالُوا هَذَا إِفْكٌ مُبِينٌ. Why did not the believers, men and women, when you heard of it, think well of themselves? And why did they say, this is a manifest lie? It means that those believers did not think good of other believers who are as their own selves when they heard hypocrites' words about their faithful persons. And why did they not say that it was a great and manifest slander? They knew the evil and notorious background of these evil hypocrites. They were certain out of a various context that such an accusation was impossible. They were well aware that that accused person was totally chaste. They knew the plots which were planned. They knew the plots which were carried out against the Holy Prophet ﷺ. Nevertheless, they must be reprimanded that they heard such false rumors and they remained silent.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the Holy Quran reprimands those Muslim believers, those men and women who heard these rumors, but they thought well of themselves and they did not say it out loud that this was a manifest slander. And the worst was when they consciously or unconsciously spread it. That's the point that makes them deserve to be reprimanded. It is interesting that instead of asking believers to think good of the one who is accused of this calumny, it says they think well of themselves. This way of speaking means that believers are of essence, and if one of them is accused, it is as though all of them are accused. They are like the limbs of each other. If world brings harm to only one of the limbs, the other limbs do not stay calm and indifferent. As one defends himself in the case of receiving accusations, one must defend his religious female and male brothers. And the use of anfus in such cases also is seen in other verses of the Holy Quran. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UN mission in Afghanistan released a report last week indicating that more than 1,000 civilians have been killed and nearly 2,700 others injured in Afghanistan since the Taliban takeover in 2021. Daesh Khorasan province, which is an affiliate of the Daesh terrorist group, has claimed responsibility for most of the assaults, especially those on the Shia Hazara community.
Unfortunately, a series of IED and suicide attacks continued in Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. We witnessed attacks on major schools, mosques, and educational centers in different provinces. Most of these attacks came as part of the ongoing systematic massacre of Shia Hazaras. Unfortunately, no fundamental steps have been taken to address this catastrophe and the ongoing miseries of the people.
The Daesh terrorist group is seeking a foothold in Afghanistan after it was defeated in Iraq and Syria. Taliban officials claim Daesh is sponsored by the West, saying they are committed to securing Afghanistan and busting the terror group. During the 2 years of the Taliban's rise to power, insecurity has taken its toll on Afghan civilians. People here are calling on the Taliban and the international community to work together for a more peaceful and prosperous future for Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pakistan breathes a sigh of relief as the IMF approves a $3 billion US dollars funding arrangement that could help stabilize its economy and save the country from a crisis that has brought millions of people to the verge of starvation. The IMF's mission chief for Pakistan, Nathan Porter, said in a statement that the flood and the rise in global commodity prices resulted by the war in Ukraine are some of the economic shocks that Pakistan has encountered in recent times. He said the agreement will help Pakistan's immediate efforts to stabilize the economy following recent external shocks, maintain macroeconomic stability, and offer a framework for funding from multilateral and bilateral partners. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif called it a good news for the country, saying that Islamabad already implemented a number of policy changes that includes reversing of export industry subsidies, raising energy and fuel costs, and arranging for the external finances on the demand of IMF. Pakistan has been experiencing its worst economic crisis in decades, which experts say could have escalated into a debt default in the absence of the IMF agreement. The deal with IMF came at a time when Pakistan's economic problems don't seem to be getting any better in 2023. As its fragile economy continues to struggle with multiple challenges, Islamabad has made several painful adjustments for securing an IMF deal. Those have further fueled all-time high inflation of 38% year-on-year in May. Moreover, Islamabad announced a new energy-saving plan last month, ordering to close all markets by 8 at night, while restaurants and wedding halls by 10 p.m. The government believes that mayors are expected to save the country about $1 billion US dollars annually.
Analysts point out that although the fresh agreement with IMF may provide short-term relief to cash-strapped Pakistan, the country's economic stability still depends on lenders' suggested fiscal reforms as well as political harmony between the government and the opposition. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The city of Melitopol in the Zaporizhia region, it was taken by Russia in February last year. With no soldiers patrolling the streets, it doesn't feel like an occupied city, but there is an active insurgency targeting officials. While the Ukrainian counteroffensive falters 70 kilometers to the north, I meet with the Russian-appointed governor of the region in his underground bunker.
Driving through the Zaporizhia region, it's clear the Russians were well prepared. Defensive lines, anti-tank dragon teeth, right throughout the region, even far to the south.
The governor now has his sights set on the city of Zaporizhia, which is still under Ukrainian control. The streets are lined with Russian flags and billboards. This one says, Russia is the country of opportunities, more opportunities for you. There are, without doubt, a lot more pro-Ukrainians here than in Donetsk. With the large pro-Russian population and those who just want peace, whether they live in Russia or Ukraine, the battle for hearts and minds in Zaporozhye will at least be far easier than for the Americans in Iraq. Meanwhile, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers are being sent to their deaths and billions of dollars spent in efforts to take back towns like this. Increasingly, questions are being asked, is it worth it? Jenny Miller, Zaporozhye.
Denouncing the act of blasphemy in the strongest terms. A group of protesters, including university students, gathered outside the Swedish embassy to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran by chanting slogans and carrying placards condemning the blasphemous move.
I've come here to say that the Holy Quran is very dear to us, and Sweden should not allow this amount of disrespect to our beliefs. This book should be respected because the names of other religious books like the Bible and the Torah are mentioned in it. Anyone who disrespects this book is also disrespecting Christians and Jews.
This level of blasphemy is totally unacceptable. We have come here to defend our beliefs, the Holy Quran and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. My husband and my son have also joined me to send this message to the world. In Sweden, they have disrespected our holy book. No act of sacrilege can ever be considered acceptable.
The angry protesters also set the Swedish flag on fire. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned Sweden's chargé d'affaires in Tehran and has also called for an emergency meeting of the foreign ministers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
The huge crowds that have gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran are also demanding the embassy to be closed down. Gisumi Shahmadi of Tehran.
After a long legal battle against the UK government's so-called Rwanda deportation plan, a welcome victory for rights campaigners and asylum seekers.
The result is that the High Court's decision that Rwanda was a safe third country is reversed, and that unless and until the deficiencies in its asylum processes are corrected, removal of asylum seekers to Rwanda will be unlawful.
It was a majority vote in the Royal Court of Appeal against a High Court decision in December last year that would have allowed the government to send asylum seekers arriving in the UK on small boats across the English Channel from France on a one-way trip to Rwanda, a plan slated by campaigners as immoral.
It's inhumane. They're treating people like they're not human beings. The reason why people are arriving on small boats in the UK is because they don't have safe passage. It's a deeply racist policy because it particularly impacts on communities that are already racialized, already face the most race discrimination in the world. And this challenge by the government needs to stop.
That is yet to happen. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who is grappling with high inflation, rising interest rates, and declining public support, has made this scheme one of his priorities. Reacting to the ruling, he said he disagreed with the court's decision and would do whatever necessary to make the deportations happen. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people entered the UK by crossing the Channel in 2022, a jump of more than 17,000 from the previous year's record. Many have since been held in detention.
It's awful. The conditions of detention centres in this country, in the UK, are worse than prison. So people are being held in horrific circumstances, in a situation that they have no control on, their lives essentially in limbo for long periods of time, and not knowing what's going to happen to them, whether they're just going to be put on a plane and deported at any moment. It's really demoralizing.
The Boris Johnson-era plan, fervently pursued by incumbent Interior Minister Suella Braverman, aims to deport asylum seekers to the East African country of Rwanda as part of a $148 million deal to deter asylum seekers.
The UK government still has the option of appealing this court's decision to the Supreme Court in what's already been a long legal process, delays that will continue to have an impact on some of the most vulnerable people who risk their lives to reach Britain. Saeed Purizab, London.
On Tuesday, in the Italian capital, a string of left-leaning groups and anti-war associations organized a demonstration dubbed Stop Sending Weapons in protest against Italy's government's relentless support for Ukraine. Rome has so far approved 7 military support packages to Kyiv, including both lethal and non-lethal equipment, for over 1 billion euros. Italians have repeatedly expressed their opposition to sending weapons to Ukraine, but their calls have so far gone utterly unheard by successive governments.
We have a serious problem in Italy. The majority of the people are deeply against the war. All surveys have been showing that, and yet these people haven't been able to get together in an association or group. Everybody has to know that the government's decisions go against the will of the people.
I think everybody understood that this very war will not have a winner. Sending weapons will, the only effect will produce is longer war.
Italy's support to Ukraine hasn't only translated into sending military equipment. Last month, Italy's defense minister Guido Crosetto announced that Rome will deploy some 3,400 of its troops on NATO's eastern flank by the end of this year. Italy has been a staunch supporter of Ukraine since day one of the conflict with Russia. Recently, Italy's foreign minister Antonio Tajani has hinted at creating a NATO-Ukraine Council at the upcoming Atlantic Alliance's summit, which will be held in Lithuania next week.
Clearly, this proposal by the Italian minister Tajani only serves the purpose of extending the duration of the war, which is in contrast with the desire of the Italians. They want peace, and I find it very positive that Cardinal Matteo Zuppi is in Moscow for a 2-day peace mission.
The Holy See has sent the president of the Italian Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Matteo Maria Zuppi, as its envoy to Moscow to foster dialogue and seek a peaceful solution to the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit will end on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
Tehran has hosted an international conference on reviewing the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Iran's Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, said that dozens of documents against U.S. sanctions have been prepared to counter such measures.
The U.S. administration used every illegitimate means to achieve its sinister goal and sought to destroy the Iranian government by putting pressure on the Iranian people. In the field of sanctions, a heavy case has been prepared against the U.S. Dozens of documents against these sanctions have been prepared, and every measure is taken to counter the sanctions against Iran.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize an issue, and this is exactly what the United States has done.
America's actions are not consistent with the commitments made in the 1948 Covenants and Declaration and other human rights documents. U.S. authorities have proven that wherever their legitimate interests and national interests require, they leave human rights documents aside, and whenever they want to oppress other governments, people, and societies, they act upon the claims of human rights violation.
The American Human Rights Week occasion in Iran marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, or the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran Islamic Republic Party. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast.
U.S. government tries to portray itself as a great savior for the world, which is really just a big lie or a great deception, because we have seen, especially since September 11th, that the U.S. has killed many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and has also made probably more than a million people, or maybe even more than 2 million people inside of the greater Middle East region. It's the U.S. government has made these people homeless.
People here say that the American version of human rights is a jab at Washington to question its dual take on human rights and to expose it to the world.
The participants believe that terrorism and sanctions are the main pillars of the American version of human rights, in the absence of which the U.S. will not be able to continue its hegemony dominance and plots across the globe. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
At shops and markets across the UK, there's only one big topic of conversation these days: inflation. The rate at which prices are rising is taking its toll. For well over a year now, prices have been rising at the fastest rate in decades. Each trip to the shop is getting worse and worse for those who can least afford it.
Perhaps this right here illustrates how bad things are. A pretty standard shop of white bread, milk, butter, and flour. About a year ago, around $9 for the whole thing. Today, around $15, and that excludes energy and rent.
And while prices have soared, incomes haven't, forcing public workers to take to the streets demanding better pay over the past year. There are all sorts of reasons for the inflation, the high energy costs, the COVID bounce back. But there's also a very UK-specific explanation.
It's called Brexit, and that's red tape. That's delays, that's the need for certification and bureaucracy. Supply chains have got disrupted, and that pushes up the price of food. And of course, a tighter labour market also, because we don't get all those EU workers coming in, you know, that help produce, you know, cheap food for the British people.
Another sign of the times, more people falling on hard times. This food bank in northwest London, one of the tens of thousands across the nation, has seen a surge in the number of people asking for help.
We've certainly noticed an increase in demand this year compared to last year because of the cost of living crisis. In fact, we've had to change our food bank policy because we were consistently giving out 300 food parcels a week for the past few months, and we're unable to keep up with the demand. And we can see that the guests we're supporting are really struggling with the cost of basic essentials.
The UK government has promised to have inflation in the next year, but those already on the brink say they cannot afford to wait. Saeed Purza, London.
EU foreign affairs ministers met on Monday to discuss the latest developments pertaining to the war in Ukraine. They suggest that the Wagner Group's armed mutiny in Russia last Saturday represents a risk because of the Federation's nuclear weapons. It's claimed the Kremlin has been weakened.
First, it was a threat because it was strong, it has force, and now it's becoming a risk because it may have entering in an era of political instability and internal fragility.
Putin claims Kiev and its Western masters wanted Russians to kill each other. Without mentioning Wagner's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, directly, Putin says the organisers of the mutiny betrayed their country. Experts have been sharing their thoughts with us.
Putin is in full control, as we have seen, and everything that was released by the mainstream media and all the politicians who are anti-Russia and supporting the war were merely expressing only their wishful thinking.
EU foreign affairs ministers have rubber-stamped an 11th package of sanctions against Russia. Many lawmakers, analysts, and even the Hungarian government say efforts to try and pressure Putin have backfired. Energy sanctions in particular have led to a cost-of-living crisis across Europe. Eurozone interest rates continue to rise. This is putting enormous strain on millions of households and businesses. Despite EU-funded investigations prior to the war revealing corruption problems at every level within Ukraine society, the 27-nation bloc continues to send billions of euro to the country. Massive amounts of deadly Western arms arrive into Ukraine every day. EU leaders are due to hold a summit this Thursday and Friday here in the Belgian capital. The war in Ukraine will dominate proceedings. If previous summits are anything to go by, do not expect a single reference to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
I would like to say to the dear ones who have lost their houses, properties and children in the battlefields, most certainly you can feel the empathy of this old servant of God and father of yours as I regard the destruction of your houses as the destruction of my own house, and the martyrdom and injury of your beloved ones and children as the martyrdom and injury of my children. I am with you. I advise you to observe fortitude and endurance. I hope that in this great divine test, the Iranian nation will rush to assist the victims with the same spirit of solidarity and fraternity that you regard one another as companions and sympathizer in all problems.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program we try to listen to some sentences and precious words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about different subjects and then make use of them as great lessons for us and in order for us to follow this great character and the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. About the Holy Book of Quran, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "Without the Quran, the gate to the knowledge of God would be shut forever." You know, it is first and foremost belief of Muslims around the globe that the Holy Book of Quran is the ultimate source of knowledge of any type. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said several times in the Holy Book of Quran that أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم لا يعزب عنه مثقال ذرة في السماوات ولا في الأرض ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين. Not even an atom's weight is hidden from him in the heavens or the earth, nor anything smaller or larger than that, but is written in a perfect record. Surah Al-Saba, verse number 3. So according to this verse, it can be stated that the Holy Quran is the ultimate source of knowledge. Here, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is giving hint to this feature of the Holy Book of Quran to be the source of knowledge for people around the world.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Beware that the science of future, knowledge of past, cure for your pains and your order is in the Holy Book of Quran." That was about the great book as a source of knowledge. So we as real Muslims should try to make use of this book and take advantage of every single word in it and make use of it in our lives and see the, you know, miraculous results in every single aspect of our lives. Okay, for ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about the Holy Book of Quran. In that regard, he said, "Without the Quran, the gate to the knowledge of God would be shut forever."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.